I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to the top religion news stories of 2018, they run the gamut from political to violent to scandalous. Today, two voting members of the Religion News Association tell us which headlines and newsmakers stood out among the multitude of stories involving church leaders, federal lawmakers, legal battles, and more. Then, an unusual combination. Actors Richard Karn and Tootie Roche are in town, appearing in America's longest-running comedy play. They also happen to be married for more than 30 years now. We'll ask them what makes for success in theater and in marriage. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When it comes to religion, a lot happened in 2018. Once again, the Religion News Association has ranked the top stories, and in the number one slot, that explosive Pennsylvania grand jury report that accused 300 priests of sexually abusing at least 1,000 minors. Named the number two religion story of the year was the tragic Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh in October that marked the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. With us today to run down the year's top religion stories are Brian Ellison. He's a KCUR contributor and talk show host. He's also an ordained Presbyterian minister and executive director of the Covenant Network of Presbyterians, and he works with the Presbyterian churches in Kansas and Missouri. Brian, always great to have you here.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Also with us is Deborah Mason. She's a retired professor of journalism at the University of Missouri. For more than two decades, she was director of the Religion News Writers Association. She joins us from KBIA in Columbia. Deborah, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
You know, Brian, you hear about membership in so many mainline denominations falling and young people turning away from organized religion. And then you look over this list of top religion stories from 2018 and you realize the resounding impact that religion still has on society. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's really true, Steve. Religion news stories are not relegated to some religion page or religion section. They really are. Religion is part of lots of top stories through all the sections of the newspaper, whether it's U.S. politics or international relations or stories of crime or immigration law. And you see that in this year's top 10 list.
You know, Deborah, what stands out to you about which stories made the list this year? What struck you?
Well, I think one of the things is that we've seen these stories before, right? I mean, we've been covering hard the sexual abuse scandals that have gone on, particularly within the Catholic Church. And those really started to blow open with the Boston Globe's reports back in 2002. Things had died down a little bit, and I think most of us thought all of those cases, all of those stories that were out there had been told. And this just, that Pennsylvania report just blew it wide open and really kind of caused a new festering of this really difficult topic.
You know, Brian, let's talk about that for a moment. Again, this Pennsylvania grand jury report that disclosed that 300 Catholic priests were accused of sexually abusing at least 1,000 minors. This story is just not going away. And you wonder, how does the Roman Catholic Church survive given the longevity of this story?
Well, and to that point, Steve, it wasn't just the number one story, which was about the diocese in Pennsylvania. The number eight story on the list this year was about retired Washington Archbishop Theodore McCarrick being barred from the ministry. The number 10 story was about bombshell accusations from a cardinal in the Vatican that the Pope had covered up sexual misconduct. So it infiltrates a lot of different stories.
It goes all the way up to the Pope himself.
Well, that's right. What I think is different here, and maybe what is significant about that Pennsylvania story, is that you are seeing, at least in some dioceses, Steve, the church addressing the situation, and in some cases even accepting responsibility, issuing apologies, releasing lists of priests who have been accused, which is something you would never have seen a decade ago. Archbishop Wuerl did resign, Cardinal Wuerl, who was a past bishop of Pittsburgh. The Vatican let an Australian bishop just last month face a criminal trial where he was convicted for right. failing to report child abuse. So it could be that you're seeing a change, but as Deborah said, we've been covering the story for a long time, and there's no sign that that's going to change.
Deborah, in broad strokes, what's been the impact on the Catholic Church in terms of membership, in terms of parishioners showing up on weekends for services? What are you seeing out there?
I don't think we have good numbers on that right now. What we do know, though, in surveys is that approval ratings, for example, of the Pope have gone down. Pope Francis is incredibly popular, but these scandals in the last few years and his handling of it have really led to people to question his judgment. And this is not just in the United States. This is ramifications globally. Chile, for instance, one of the issues was that Chile's entire bishops, they all retired. They all resigned, as a result of how they handled some of these claims. And the Pope, of course, is having a large meeting coming up, I believe, in February, where he will be addressing this and, I think, really hoping to get it very clear that the church is not going to tolerate these kinds of things anymore.
You know, Brian Ellison, I think I've read that meeting in February that Deborah just mentioned is shaping up as something of a pivotal moment here when it comes to the church addressing this ongoing scandal.
A pivotal moment for the church, Steve, and also for the Pope himself. His record has been decidedly mixed. He has done a lot of things that have put forward a step of openness, but at the same time, he has been criticized for his slow response in places like Chile that Deborah mentioned. Also in November, remember, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops was prepared to step forward with a code of conduct for priests, prepared to set up a commission to respond to sexual abuse complaints, and the Vatican actually put the kibosh on that plan until this February summit. So we shall see, but I think you're right. I think the February meeting will be very significant.
I'm confused. You know, why would the Roman Catholic Church be responding so slowly to a scandal of this magnitude, Deborah? Who is advising the Pope? Why aren't we seeing faster action here? Why on earth would the actions of American bishops be scotched, as Brian Ellison just explained to us here?
Well, of course, it's pretty clear that the U.S. bishops have faced this in the past, and they addressed it in the past, and those things that they put into place weren't successful in unearthing some of these older cases and some of these top leaders who continued to be shielded by the church. I think, too, though, that we have to remember that we often look at the Vatican and look at church communities as if they are politicians, and they are very political in some ways, but churches, and particularly the huge Roman Catholic Church, move very, very slowly. And so whereas it's hard for us to imagine any other issue that might be at the forefront for Pope Francis, at least that's certainly the way I feel, he may have all sorts of other issues where you have, priests being murdered, you have governments trying to put into place priests that aren't of this Pope's choosing, and all sorts of other kinds of complicated things. So I think it's important to remember that.
Right. Not to mention the palace intrigue within the Vatican of his own bishops and cardinals, who in some cases apparently don't support him.
Right. Brian, we're almost two decades into this ongoing scandal, though. And again, I'm just struggling with trying to understand. I get institutions move slowly, but this is just so far beyond the pale for so many people at this point.
Well, I guess I'd have two things to say about that. One is we should not overestimate the control that the Vatican actually has over parishes and dioceses all around the world. I think we portray it as this monolithic institution with an all-powerful pope, and in theory it is that, and yet the reality of however many Catholics there are in the world, I think it's close to a billion, is that you don't actually have the kind of control that in theory you have. And so I think on one level, the pope is ultimately responsible, but on a day-to-day basis, this isn't something that you can change with a snap of your fingers. The other thing I think we should probably point out at this point is that the Catholic Church is not the only religious institution that has had challenges with clergy sexual abuse. Many Protestant denominations in the United States and other groups around the world have also faced accusations and have, in more or less similar fashion, struggled to respond in ways that were satisfying not only to victims but to those who want to see safer churches and houses of worship in the future.
Okay, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're running down the top religion news stories of 2018 with Brian Ellison from KCUR, Deborah Mason, who for more than two decades was director of the Religion News Writers Association that ranks these top stories each year. Let's turn to a different one. This was the passing of the Reverend Billy Graham at age 99. Deborah, he was the chaplain to presidents. And are we going to see another Billy Graham in our lifetimes?
You know, I think that's been the big question, and one of the reasons why this was such a big story. It ranked number three in the top 10 list. We haven't seen one yet. Every so often, we think maybe one has come along, and they invariably, you know, kind of fall from their perch for various reasons. So, what I'm seeing rather is that there are different audiences now than there used to be. I mean, Billy Graham was one of the few of such ministers who had these large revivals, but also they were broadcast on television, and those were in the very early days in the 40s and 50s. And nowadays, there's so much content and so much clutter on cable, satellite, channels, radio channels, that I think it's hard for one particular individual to rise to the top the way Billy Graham did.
Brian, as he leaves the scene, how was he regarded at the end of his life? What were his major contributions here?
Well, I think on a certain level, it was a generally positive feeling that folks had about Billy Graham. I mean, you asked if there would ever be another one. One thing I am certain there will not be is another sort of bipartisan, another religious leader who is respected equally, it seems, by Democrats and Republicans. And remember, Billy Graham prayed at the White House with every president from Truman to George H.W. Bush, and was regarded across the spectrum fairly positively. Having said that, though, Steve, I think there were questions raised at the end of his life, in honesty, about whether he did as much as he could beyond praying with presidents to promote actions that were just, that were promoting equity and fairness and other things that many would regard as part of the Christian message.
To actually challenge presidents to do more in some cases.
Well, that's right. Part of being studiously nonpartisan means that you don't necessarily push in places that a lot of Christian leaders were pushing. So the civil rights movement, a lot of people said Billy Graham was missing in action as other, even white pastors were marching in Selma. Billy Graham wasn't there. Billy Graham, of course, made some comments on the Nixon White House tapes that were released years later that were generally seen as anti-Semitic. And he said he didn't recall making them, but he apologized for doing so. And so, you know, it was a mixed record in some people's minds. But generally, when you look back at who Billy Graham was, his message wasn't a very political one. The gospel he preached, if you will, was one about salvation, about going to heaven instead of going to hell. And and that's a different message than a lot of the religious leaders we see today interacting with presidents. Take someone like Jerry Falwell Jr., who just this week in an interview said, "I support the president's policies. There's nothing he could do personally that would make me stop supporting him because I stand with him on these social issues and these political issues of the day." That is a different thing than Billy Graham ever would have said. And so we are in a different place.
The next one on the list here, Deborah, the number two story of the Religion News Association rankings of the top stories of the year. In the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history, a gunman kills 11 worshipers at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. This attack comes as surveys show growing anti-Semitism in the West and decreasing awareness of the Holocaust. The takeaway here should be what?
Well, I think, again, this is a very old story and that we mustn't be complacent about hate-fueled speech, particularly when we're hearing it from our leaders or when it is being condoned by them. I think, too, that this goes hand in hand with Islamophobia, which has also risen in the last few years, really since 2015, levels of Islamophobic activities, slurs, and so forth have similarly risen. And I think what's not said in this particular item that was listed on the top 10 is that this has parallels also, particularly in Western Europe, where anti-Semitism, homophobia, Islamophobia, you know, really hate-fueled speech and rhetoric has been uplifted by nationalist, populist groups all across Western Europe, and it's disturbing.
Yeah, obviously, Steve, this is a story that hit close to home here in the Kansas City area after the attack on the Jewish Community Center back in 2014, which turns out to have been sort of a tragic precursor to the much greater number of victims in Pittsburgh. You know, but I agree with Deborah that reporting, and you've seen this in good news reporting over the last few years, this is part of a bigger issue. A study about awareness of the Holocaust that came out last year revealed that 31% of Americans and 41% of those under age 35 believe that fewer than 2 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust, when the actual number is 6 million. Mm. Two-thirds of millennials couldn't say what Auschwitz was, 66%. Mm. What this all suggests to me, at least, is that the response by leaders, a thoughtful response, is the only thing that really can start to change this and swing things back the other way, whether that's a political response or a religious response. And conversations about what we mean when we say terrorism. Those are all things that are going to have to happen in the U.S. because this is part of a larger trend.
And, you know, I also want to just mention that we are on the cusp of really losing the last of the Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. So although there have been some really significant efforts to record their stories and tell those stories, I mean, we've got to make sure that those stories are disseminated and keep being told even after that generation has passed on.
You know, we talked about the number three story. That was the death of Billy Graham. Number four, religious leaders oppose the Trump administration on immigrant family separation policies and the decision to turn away asylum seekers at the border. Catholic bishops rebuke Trump policies during a June meeting. Brian, have we seen religious leaders stand up to a president quite like this before?
Well, you know, it's not unusual for religious leaders to take stands. Even the Catholic bishops over the generations have taken policy stands on abortion and on euthanasia and on war in general. And as we know, actually, in all of those cases, it doesn't appear they've been terribly influential on changing policy or even on changing the minds of Catholics, who mm-hmm. generally line up with the general public for the most part. I think this is a significant moment, though, on the issue of immigration, because it isn't just the Catholic bishops taking stands. You see mainline Protestants, you see even evangelical, non-denominational leaders saying, wait a minute, the way that we treat people as a society is a fundamental religious issue, and we don't have to draw partisan lines about this. There's some things happening that shouldn't be happening.
After years of legal battles, the Supreme Court rules in favor of Jack Phillips, a Colorado baker who refused on religious grounds to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. This is the number five story. Why does this one rank so high, Deborah?
Well, you know, this story really gets at the breach of understanding of what is religious freedom and where does religious freedom end and where do basic human rights begin, and the kind of that rough spot where those two core aspects of democracies clash. You know, this case had been watched for quite some time. The ruling, however, was quite narrow. And so I think the question of how far can people use the freedom of religion to restrict other individuals' rights is unanswered at this point. And so it's going to keep going on and continue to be kind of a flashpoint, I think, in our culture for the next few years.
Okay, as we begin to wrap up here, I wanted to ask each of you about a story that didn't make the top 10, but you still thought was a pretty big deal. Brian Ellison, what did you cite here?
Well, I think the story that was not listed and that I think would have been captured if Donald Trump had been named the religion newsmaker of the year, but he was not, is just how much Donald Trump's presidency has changed the way religious conservatives engage with politics in America. Now, you know, religious conservatives in politics is not a new story. That's a decades-old story. But I think we've seen just in the last 2 years this unqualified support for Trump by those who previously identified as religious leaders, in many cases the actual sons of the previous generation, Franklin Graham and Jerry Falwell Jr., that has totally flipped the script about faith and politics. You don't hear them talking about integrity and about character. You hear them talking about conservative political policy positions being supreme. I think we're going to see now a real change in how conservatives, religious conservatives who want to engage in politics, what avenues they have to engage, having sort of given away the integrity conversation in their willingness to stand with Donald Trump and to simply say outright, we don't care what he did in private. We don't care what he does. You wouldn't have heard them saying that about Bill Clinton a generation ago, and I don't think they'll be able to say it again.
Deborah, what story did you cite?
Well, I think it was similar to Brian's story, and I might disagree a little bit with him, but I am starting to see a fissure in the evangelical community and with people who are now maybe formerly considered themselves evangelical and now are starting to rethink how they categorize themselves. They're not comfortable with Donald Trump's representation of democracy and the kind of language that he uses to separate people and to denounce whole demographics. I also think that the average age of evangelicals, white evangelicals in this country, is about age 55. And so really in recent years, people keep talking about the demographic change that is coming to white evangelicalism, and that change is that younger evangelicals are not as passionate about some of these culture war issues like abortion that have captured the older white evangelicals. And you also have this growing number of black and brown evangelicals in this country, many immigrants who find President Trump's policies on immigration really hurtful, hateful, and they oppose them strongly. So I think it's a really interesting time. As Brian said, I mean, it really goes back to Reagan when white evangelicals have held power. And since at least 2012, they've been 26% of the voters, even in the midterm elections.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to watch that significant group.
That's Deborah Mason. For more than two decades, she was director of the Religion Newswriters Association. She's a retired professor of journalism over at Mizzou. Deborah, thanks for the time.
Oh, thank you.
Brian Ellison, KCUR contributor, ordained Presbyterian minister. Always great to have you too, Brian.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. Coming up, we meet Richard Karn of Home Improvement fame and his real-life wife, Tootie Roche. They'll be in town for a production at the New Theater Restaurant. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the superintendent of the Lee Summit School District joins us to discuss boundary changes, the district's master plan, and education equity. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this is how Hollywood works sometimes. As the story goes, Richard Karn had received a traffic ticket and was in traffic school, where he sat beside an agent who told him about casting for a new TV show, Home Improvement. Turns out the role of Al Borland had already been given to somebody else, and then that guy got tied up with a movie, and the role had to be recast. Enter Richard Karn, who got the job, but continued to work as an apartment building manager in case the show floundered. Richard is married to Tootie Roche, an actress who also appeared in the series and has more than 300 credits to her name. Together, they are starring in Sheer Madness at the new theater restaurant, where the audience gets to figure out who done it. And they are here with me in the studio right now. Richard Karn, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Tootie, good to have you too. Welcome
to
Kansas City.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Is that really how it happened, Richard? Is that how you got your start?
Well, there's a lot more that goes on to those kind of things. But basically, yeah. I mean, I actually met the producers, Matt, David, and Carmen, a few years before that in New Harmony, Indiana.
You knew them already.
Well, they were doing the New Harmony Project, which was new playwrights in progress. And as an actor, I would read the plays for them. And so many years later, when Tootie and I moved out to California, I gave them a call, found out that they were doing Carol and Company and had just finished the first season of Roseanne and all that kind of stuff. And then I found out about this audition of these guys I know. They didn't tell me that they were doing that, but they said, well, you know, it's already cast. We got Stephen Topolowski in there to do it.
Yeah.
But come in anyways. And it worked out. I was able to fill in for Stephen, and then I kept filling in for him. And finally they goes, you know what? This works.
You know, Tootie, when he got home from traffic court that day, that historic day in his life, did he mention this to you? Was it something that you guys kicked around?
Well, he did. He said that he, on a break in the traffic school, he had met an agent that said that these three were doing a new show. And we talked about it, and I said, yeah, call them. You know, what can't hurt?
I mean, this is really a classic kind of Hollywood story that people think anybody can become a star, and this is sort of how it works sometimes.
Well, it's true, but I mean, that is kind of, if you think about it, though, the background before that, though, was working many years in New York, and then, as he said, he met them initially at New Playwrights in New Harmony, and so he did know them, and so all of that helps. The background helps as well.
You had paid some dues, Richard.
Yes.
Well, you know, I did summer stock in Michigan, and a director calls me a few years later and goes, well, you know, we lost this guy in New Harmony, and would you like to come in for $100 a week stipend? I go, yeah, sounds like a great job. And I meet these guys, and I had no clue about what they did. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew that they were writing television, but I didn't know what that meant. So when I suggested to them that we should do like a spoof of all of the other people that were working for the 2 weeks at New Harmony, they go, oh, yeah. But, you know, they're up till 3-4 o'clock in the morning doing rewrites in their real job.
Yeah.
And for me to suggest that they do that, you know, in something that they're doing in Indiana, which they loved, and we had a great time. And that's kind of how we became friends.
So Home Improvement starts off and you get the part. Did you really keep your job as an apartment building manager?
We did. We kept it for about, I don't know, 3 or 4. Well, it started in July, and people didn't really see it until
September,
October.
Yeah.
And somewhere into October, I get this phone call from somebody down on the second floor going that their kitchen sink's backed up. And I go, okay, well, let me take a look, you know, because there's some things I can do.
Yes.
Well,
you know,
but as actors, what we did was we waited. We stayed being managers. We waited to find out if it was picked up. Because why leave a working gig?
Yeah, free rent.
Yes.
Yes.
That's why we stayed doing it for a while. But we were also pregnant at the time.
But when I go down there, you know, to see if the if it stopped up or whatever. There's like 15 of their friends. And they go, you see, we got Al Borland as our apartment manager. Yeah,
this is
and,
really cool.
And it struck me, go, you know what? I think it's time to, you know, I think we're okay with the job.
People started saying they had stopped up sinks just to go ahead and meet you with the TV star then,
well,
right?
We had a prolific apartment building. One of the guys that took over my job ended up writing for Power Rangers. We had we had a Playboy Playmate, you know, in the building.
Yeah.
I never told you about
that.
Yeah,
I knew that.
Yeah. Well, Home Improvement lasted 8 seasons. It starred Tim Allen, and it gave Pamela Anderson her start. Tell us about working with Tim Allen. Yeah, I know you're still close to him, I think.
Tim is the funniest guy I know. And he can just take whatever happened the day before and weave it into some story that you're laughing. And if you're not laughing right away, you know, 3 hours later, he's worked it out and, you know, he's like a dog with a bone. He's not going to let go. And every day it was just a lot of fun because he wanted to have a happy set. There wasn't, you know, we didn't want drama. We don't want.
Makes a big difference, I bet.
And Tool Time on the show was always rehearsed first in the morning because Pat wanted to she had just had twins and she didn't want to come in early. I found all this out later. It's like, why am I always coming in first?
Yeah.
But so we first 20 minutes, 30 minutes, we're just sitting around talking and kidding around. And then we would get down to what the scene was about and like that. And it was the best job. It was very different than our background of doing theater where you don't touch the script. I mean, if you're doing Ibsen or Shakespeare or Neil Simon or whatever, you don't go, you know, this doesn't work. Let's rewrite this. You know, so all of a sudden we're doing television and things are getting changed and a joke that I had is gone. I go, no, I didn't do it right last time. It's a good joke. You guys wrote a good joke. No, we think we got something. Well, let me do it one more time and you can hear your own joke better out of my mouth. So it was a very different medium to be a part of.
Tootie, how did you get your job at Home Improvement?
Well, like I said, when he got the job, I was pregnant, and our son was born at the end of the first season. But even when I was pregnant, the casting director, I met her,
Deb
Rilski, and she said, "You know, you look like Pat, and this we're going to be having her. She has 3 sisters in their." They hadn't been on, but in their scripts for the future.
Right.
You look a lot like her, and I want to bring you in and for one of the sisters. And I was like, okay, that's great. You know, at the time, it was all about, oh, it's a baby and setting up that. But I had been acting forever already, and so I was thrilled. And then she comes up to me one time and says, "Tootie, we're casting one of the sisters, but you're not right for this sister. I want you to be a different sister, so I'll bring you in next time." And I was still going, okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't top on my list, and we were very fortunate and blessed.
But she still had to audition for it.
I did.
Like they just gave
I did to have her. To audition. I didn't get it just because I slept with one of the regulars.
Yeah.
I had to audition.
Who were you sleeping with?
You.
Yeah, who was that? Yeah. Well, how did the acting bug bite the two of you? Where did it come from in your life?
I think it came out of school.
Yeah.
You know, high school theater. And we had a prolific high school. We did lots of things. We had a really great drama teacher, and I got into it early on, and I felt very comfortable and nervous at the same time. It was, you know, it was really scary and fun, and once you figure out you can make people laugh, it's really nice, and I think I just kept gravitating towards that.
Even though in your own background, Richard, your father was something of a builder, a contractor type
guy. Yeah, he was
a builder.
And his dad and my gramp, you know, his dad were both builders, built homes, built the house I grew up in. And then
it's a weird combination of traits to have the builder thing and have the actor thing. And
my grandma says to me, I remember this, I was like 9 or 10 years old. She goes, "You know, if you become a builder, I'm going to wrap you in this blanket here and throw you in Lake Washington."
She'd had enough.
I didn't quite understand what that meant, you know, because I wasn't thinking about what I was going to be yet.
Yeah. But it was ironic that his father and grandfather are builders, and then he's got a gig on Home Improvement.
Yeah. Where did the acting bug get you, Tootie?
Well, actually, mine started more probably with dance. My mom put me in dance when I was like 4 years old, and I did a lot of dance, and we had recitals. And in that, our teacher also would find out other things people did and use that in the recital, which I was singing because I'm a singer.
You sing, you dance, and you act.
Yes, and I did all of that. I did the singing and dancing for years, and then in junior high I started doing plays in high school, and then when I went to college, that's what I was going to do. I was a theater major and a double music dance minor, and my plan was just to go to New York. It always was, and that's what I did. Mm. I went a little before Rick did, but we met doing a play in New York.
So she can sing, dance, and act. Can you?
Absolutely.
Let's just go with that, right?
She sang with the Boston Pops, wow. You know, for gosh sakes.
Not bad.
You know, she's got really good pipes, and I try to get her to sing at functions. And you know, once she's up there, she loves it. But, the act of actually getting up there, because, you know, she's a trained singer, and she doesn't want to just wing it.
So what's your preference, Tootie? Stage, TV, film? Where do you prefer to work?
Well, that's a hard question, because I enjoy all of it, but majority of my past has been stage.
Mm-hmm.
He's done much more television and film, and I did some of the Home Improvements and some little smaller roles on film.
Yeah.
But I love all of it. I love, you know, as an artist, you love performing. It's in your blood.
Yeah.
It's going to be there. But I keep going back to the foundation of stage. To me, I just love stage,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
How did you two meet, Richard?
We met doing a play called The Other Shore by Jose Lopez Rubio, who's kind of like Spain's Neil Simon.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Bobby, who she had worked with kind of on an industrial or something,
mm-hmm.
Cast me and her. We didn't know each other at that point. And we got to know each other during the run of that play,
mm-hmm.
and kind of ended up together. And then we did a play off Broadway. We did a couple of plays.
Yes. But the funny thing about that is Rick realized that we had met each other before.
Oh, gosh.
And he told me, I didn't remember this, that we both went in for a commercial audition. And you tell it.
Oh, yeah, like a year before, it was for Curtis Mathis Television. You remember Curtis Mathis?
Sure,
they were like console. They were huge.
Yes.
They're a huge piece of furniture. And the story of this commercial was that we were living in a trailer park and a tornado goes through, but our Curtis Mathis still works.
And the
trailer's gone.
The trailer's gone.
But the Curtis Mathis, we can still get.
But the irony in it is that we are a Southern couple, and I'm from Texas, and he's from Seattle. And the irony is that he got the commercial and I didn't.
Oh, that's really funny. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. I'm visiting with Richard Karn, Tootie Roche. They're appearing together in Sheer Madness at the New Theater Restaurant now through February 17th. For more information and tickets, go to newtheater.com. Oh, so what are the pros and cons of working together? Tootie, what would you say, Tootie?
I just have the good. You know, I can only speak for myself, but I love working with him. And someone said, okay, so you're here, you're living here, because we're in a house together here and living. So it's 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it. I love it because we have a great time. We have a great time in life, and we have a great time. I have a great time on stage. Again,
that can be tricky, though.
Speak for
can
myself.
It, Richard, I mean...
Well, it can be tricky because on Home Improvement, when she got cast as Jill's sister, you know, we've had lots of guest stars come on, and sometimes it doesn't always work. And they changed her character and what she did like three times before midweek. And it occurred to me, you know, at the last moment after she'd already gotten the job, well, what if she doesn't feel like she's doing it very well? Or
what if she doesn't do well?
You know, it's like, oh my God, how horrible would that be?
Right.
You
right,
know, but
right.
She, you know, flying colors, she was great. But working together is fun. Yeah. You know, it's you don't ever want to tell other actors how to do their their role or, right. or whatever. But every once in a while we say, you know, it'd be funnier or this moment might be more poignant.
Right.
You know, this and that. And we're okay with that. There's not like a huge competitiveness.
So the show lasted, what spanned 8 seasons. And when it came to an end, I want to think in like 1999, how big of an adjustment was it not to have the sitcom to fall back on?
Wow.
It was a moment, right?
Well,
yeah.
Having been actors in New York, and if you're smart about it, actually, and not just actors, in life, but as far as actors, you work some and then you're off and you mm-hmm. work. So if you're smart about it, you save when you're working to try to be fine after that. And so we were smart about it. With Home Improvement, we did buy a house, and it was our first house and everything. But
yeah, but Cooper was born the first season,
our son.
You know, we couldn't go crazy,
right?
You know, if I'd gotten that job at 23, I don't think I'd be alive,
right?
I would have just been gone.
Yeah,
but we were smart about it, and then I don't remember. It wasn't how long was it that he then did Family Feud, and mm-hmm. he did 4 years of that
right.
as well,
which was a left turn at Albuquerque. Yeah, you know, because all of a sudden, it's a hybrid. It's not really theater. It's not really TV. It's not scripted.
Yeah.
So like you, you have to come up with things to say. And am I going to be that good? I remember Richard Dawson being very funny in this.
Oh,
and I go,
hard guy to follow.
I had a Richard Dawson moment. It was hysterical. I don't know if we have time. But
we do.
When I was in training at the University of Washington, a friend of mine, Kevin Moriarty, and I used to make fun of Richard Dawson. You know, we'd say, you know, survey says, and we'd try to make up the most ridiculous, you know, show me chicken necks.
Yeah.
You know, and we would laugh and crack ourselves up. Well, fast forward to doing I'm the Host, and we have the NASCAR drivers and their pit crew on against each other for a ratings week. And parts of a chicken come up. And the first guy, you know, the breast, the leg, the thigh. And then the fourth guy goes, chicken necks. And I looked at him, and this all came rushing back. I'd completely forgotten about it. And all I wanted to do was stop and go, oh, my God, you guys don't understand how funny this is.
Yeah,
you know,
I've been down this road.
Under my breath, I went, okay, Kev, this one's for you. Show me chicken necks.
Yeah.
And it was up there.
Well, that much improvisation going on the fly, that's not for everybody.
It is. But, you know, you have a safety net because if you can't think of something funny, you just play the game.
Right.
You just go back to the game. And
right.
I'm not a stand-up necessarily, you know. And stand-ups are tougher because they'll go for the jugular. I didn't want to make people feel really uncomfortable or whatever. But
yeah. Well, I'm just struck at, you know, Tootie, this play you're doing at the new theater right now, Sheer Madness, sounds just so difficult because this is an interactive play around this murder mystery. And Richard plays Detective Eddie Lawrence. Tootie, you're Barbara.
No, I'm not a detective. I am a antique dealer.
Antique dealer. Okay. And Tootie, you're Barbara DeMarco?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hairstylist.
But the plot changes from show to show. The audience interacts and tries to help you all solve it. And one script one day is different very much from the next day.
Yes.
So you're on top of your toes all the time here.
You do. You have to be on your toes. And it is physically and mentally, it can be a challenge.
I can only imagine.
And it does change. Every show has been different because the audience does have the opportunity to basically cross-examine us or investigate.
And help solve the crime.
And so it's different questions every night. Well, what happened when you did this and that? So and much of it is scripted, but sometimes they throw us for a loop and we're like, okay.
Yeah.
Usually I'm on the other side of the stage. This is kind of interesting.
Yes.
You get to watch the show from another part of the stage.
Yeah. Well, how do you handle that? That notion of you don't quite know what's coming from one day to the next.
Well, I'll tell you, the cast is amazing. There are six of us, and Jim Kerenke is the head detective, and he kind of is the ringmaster because he is the one that talks to the audience and says, "What are your questions? What do you have to do?" So he will guide it towards you know, we don't change it. He will guide it and just help us to know what we're going to answer. But at times, even the guidance, it's difficult with some people. Sometimes the audience is shouting out things, and it's kind of overwhelming. But
people love to solve mysteries, don't
yes,
they?
And everybody
they so
wants
into
to
it.
Be into it and be right.
And be right.
But as
yeah.
Rick says, the thing is, there's not a right. It's just different every night. It's not whether they've gotten it wrong or right. It's what they get out of it.
Well, explain that to me, because the person who's guilty on a Tuesday night might be a different person on
yeah.
Friday night?
Yes. Exactly, yeah.
Okay, and the cast is just rolling with
it's
that.
It's funny, because this time around, a lot of the audience wants the cops to be guilty.
Yes.
you know, that's
it's like
probably
the whole,
a change.
The whole you know, flavor of what's going on with authority figures is not crumbling, but it's like, well, the cops were there. Why were they there? And maybe they did it.
So for the audience, then, this is a completely different experience than they're used to having in the theater. This is
yes.
This is participatory.
Yes, because we lose the fourth wall.
Mm-hmm.
The lights come up, and they're involved. And it's fun. I think a lot of them enjoy it. And
but they're
some,
not forced into it, because they don't have to
no.
say anything. It's just the lights are up, and so now everybody can see each other.
Or ask questions and
yeah.
and try to figure out what happened.
Yeah. Linda here, Cher, wants to know, she's seen the play, and she says you play the hairstylist, Tootie, and she wants to know how you learned to do hair so well, and 'cause you do it well, she says.
Well, so. Thank you. I actually had some people ask me that. Did she train for that? But, you know, part of it is just in life doing my own hair for my life.
Yeah.
But in theater, sometimes you wear wigs, sometimes you don't. And I'm just so used to doing my own hair forever. And I did practice. I had to practice a few times with Merle's hair. That's who I do her hair during the show. I wash it, I roll it, and then I style it later.
Yeah.
And if this acting thing doesn't work out.
That's what someone, that's what a gentleman said to me one night.
We can now buy our own salon.
He said, if that doesn't work out, you can be a hairstylist. I went, well, thank you.
Well, I was just laughing in preparing for this last night, because I teach up the hill here at the university. And one of the stories I have beginning journalists write is a story about a murder that's taken place on campus. And it's all made up. But after 5 minutes, the kids sort of lose sight of the journalistic thrust here, and they're trying to solve the crime,
right.
Which is besides the point. But,
yes.
You know, people really want to solve these things when they get involved with a murder case like this.
Well, this play evolved out of a Swedish playwright who went to a seminar with Swedish police where they staged some type of a crime, and then they would have people witness this and teach the policeman how to, you know, ask people questions or what they saw. And he noticed that people saw very different things. You know, in the same room, they
yes.
saw very different things. They thought, yes. well, this could be interesting on stage. And he kind of did a dry version of that for stage. But then the guys who eventually took this to America and started it in Boston in 1980, they created a more humorous way
uh-huh.
of dealing with all these people. Because the first half hour of the show, people are witnessing the show. But they don't realize they're witnessing what could possibly be a crime, necessarily.
Yeah. Well, the show, again, is Sheer Madness at the New Theater Restaurant. It runs through February 17th. Tickets, more information, newtheater.com. Richard, so great to have you here. Tootie, great to have you here, too. Hope you enjoy your ride. I've met so many great Hollywood figures doing these interviews over the years, and Morgan Fairchild and Connie Stevens and everybody else. And hope you have a great run.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank so good you to have so you much guys for here. Having us.
Tomorrow on the show, the last original Brookside business is moving out. We talk with the owners of Shop Beautiful about its 86-year history. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.